This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Bill Parris on the 13th of August 2003 at 2:40 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Parris is in Piedmont, South Dakota. All right, sir, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's just one thing that I'm going to bring up, and it's something that I guess we haven't really touched upon, but I think if you're going to read about war, which I assume somebody is doing if they're going to pile through my poor history, there's something that I want to make very, very, very clear. And it's this business in warfare about atrocities. That on the outside, most people, I think, if you stand on a street corner and show them pictures or give them a situation and say, is this an atrocity? Most people will react and say, within a certain range, oh, yes, this is an atrocity. Oh, no, that's not an atrocity. But I want to try and explain how war shifts that boundary. That war in and of itself is an atrocity, if you will. It is, and if you define atrocity as an unusual violent act that has, you know, some illegality tinge to it, if you will, I think that in war, men who fight each other develop their own code. That's not what society says. But within the context of the Vietnam War, I'll give you an example. That there were times we shot unarmed men, and there were times that we shot men who should have been prisoners. And we did that based on the moment, okay? There, and I'm not trying to excuse this, or I don't care, but what I want people to understand is how this happens and then what the value system is for a combat soldier, because if I'm in contact and we're really going at it and I can't secure that prisoner, I'm not going to let him go and fight him again. That's what he's going to do. He's going to go find a weapon, and we're going to start all over again. So he's going to die, and if that happens to me, I'm going to die. I understand that, okay? People who aren't fighting wars don't have to. It looks on the nature of it, if I just bring you into the picture and show, here's this guy gunning down, quote, an unarmed man, is that an atrocity? Well, I'm here to tell you, given certain situations, no, that not only is not an atrocity, it's trying to stay alive. However, there are things that happen on the battlefield that are totally unnecessary, that are particularly vicious, cruel, and harsh, and that is the making of war against people that you can protect. You take that same situation where that man as a prisoner, and I can secure him, and I can keep him safe and my people safe, then if I shoot him, that's an atrocity. And I hope that makes sense. What someone like Lieutenant William Calley did with his platoon in 1969 is an atrocity. I've been in that situation. I've been in villages. I know who's putting the booby traps out at night. I know who's mining the road at night. But so what? You know, our rules say if you can catch them, fine. Now, you know, if I get in a situation where, you know, I catch them at it, that's different. Mm-hmm. So there are rules, and it becomes highly emotional with people who have never been pushed to the limits of their emotional and physical experience to try and understand that. But that examples I gave you are pretty much the rules that I think most decent military people try and follow.
Now, did you did you yourself witness other things that you thought were atrocious on a personal level while you were in Vietnam?
Yeah. And then one time I did one. And that was pretty horrible. And I did not realize until I did it how bad I was getting mentally. It was right during the Tet battle. It was after my former platoon had almost been wiped out. The situation was starting to stabilize, and I was under, I'll just say, worse emotional duress than normal. And what I did, I'm not proud of, but, you know, it caught me up, believe me. I mean, after that, and I have spent a long time regretting it, but that's not something I can defend. It's just something that happened, and I'm sorry about it, but it did happen, and I've seen other people do it. And at the time, the step you take with other people is you get them away, you get them calmed down, you know, because usually it's when emotions run really high. Normally, people aren't like that, even in combat.
Was there any...
Was that vague enough for you?
Sure.
Yeah, that was good. Eh?
What mechanisms were in place to help you, besides your comrades, your buddies, your fellow soldiers, what else was in place to help deal with those issues, those problems?
Well, I ran into this again on my second tour.
Okay.
But to answer your question now here... none. That's why, you know, if I say to you, well, Steve, those are jungle rules, you would think, okay, things slip a little. If I tell that to another Vietnam vet, hey, it's jungle rules, he knows exactly what I'm talking about, because jungle rules mean there are no rules. You're inventing as you go. Nobody's looking. Nobody knows. Nobody's going to rat you off, particularly because shit happens, I guess. So, no. It's one of the real dangers of warfare. 19-year-old kids start making their own rules.
What about counseling by the chaplains or anything like that? Did you have access to that? Did you
I spent a lot of time with the chaplain, actually.
you did spend a lot of time?
Yeah, I did, because it was right around that whole period of time that I ran out of Catholic faith. Particularly after the 19th of April, when the helicopter pilots had such a bad day. So many of them lost, and I just ran out of everything simultaneously, as we used to say, in flying. Mm-hmm. And I went to the chaplain. He was a wonderful man. He's 45 years old. Volunteered to go in the Army as a chaplain, volunteered for jump school, tried to go to Ranger school, and they laughed him off and said, hell no, get out of here, and sent him over to be a battalion chaplain. And he was a wonderful man. And he and I used to share a bottle of mass wine. If there's anything nastier in the world, believe me, it's drinking hot mass wine at night. Mm-hmm. But there we were. And I kept posing the question to him, how can God be happy with what we're doing? I mean, the thought came to me one day, this guy that I've killed, what happens if he's the man who is supposed to come up with a cure for cancer? Now, when the hell have I done? Mm-hmm. Well, when you start getting that sort of philosophical bent, you're in real trouble as an infantryman. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was, you know, probably past my 1,000-mile check. Mm-hmm. emotionally, I was getting really ragged. And I had done that other thing. I went and I went to confession and I talked to him, and he kept saying, look, you know, some of these things there are no answers for. You just have to stick with what you know. And what you know is God loves you and he's here, and no, he's not pleased, but he understands. Well, you know, that's great, but what what I discovered was that my religion didn't stretch far enough to cover that. That's a personal thing. That's got nothing to do with the religion, the Catholic faith, or any other. Mm-hmm. What I was really saying is, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can face this fact. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm, you know, doing the right thing. And then he got hit, the chaplain, probably a week later, he was out with our Alpha company, and boy, they ran into a buzzsaw, and he was, what a hero. Guy kept going up and pulling casualties out and doing first aid, and then he got hit pretty bad, and then he was gone, and I was sort of alone with my question. And that question stuck with me, and and then later on my second tour, when I really needed it, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the point where you were seeking guidance from the chaplain, what was motivating you, what was driving you? Was it actually concern over your mortal soul, or was this something more concern over the here and now, and over your sanity, your humanity?
I'd say it's a part of all of that.
Okay.
Because war strips you to such an absolute basic level, you cannot believe how low a level of functioning it is to be an infantryman in combat. It's just, I mean, if you use to anything, anything aesthetic, anything, I don't even know how to find words for this, but it's such a mean, low level of existence of killing and violence and waiting to kill and waiting to be killed, and it wears on you, and there's no real opportunity for the soul to feel anything sensitive, because you're so locked down, and you hunger for that so desperately, and you get so eaten up with just living like an organism that fights and, you know, lives like worse than any dog ever lived, just waiting to react like some sort of spider when a fly falls in the trap. I can remember we were in the Central Highlands, and we were going down this trail, and we heard water, and water is a very important commodity to an infantryman, and so we all went to look for the water, and we found this pool and a little tiny waterfall. And I, honest to God, thought of the pictures I'd seen of the Garden of Eden, because this pool, which is about 18 feet across, maybe 3-4 feet deep, tiny little waterfall, and there is an orchid, bush, tree, whatever, damn thing was big, and there were orchids everywhere, and the smell was just phenomenal. And it was like somebody hit me with a ball bat. Here was something, you know, so pristine, so unspoiled. I just got tears in my eyes, and I thought, oh, my God, there is beauty in this world. But, you know, look at this. And I just sat there and smoked about 2 cigarettes and just looked. You know, it was just, what a feast for the eyes. And that's so rare. You miss it so much. You hunger for things that are normal, and what you don't realize is that you've evolved into this organism that is going to have to really fight to ever get back to being able to even make touch with stuff like that. That if you're not careful, it's the analogy I often think of with myself is it's kind of like the Star Wars movie, the very first one. And if you're not, war turns you into Darth Vader, and you're always on the dark side of the Force, and you have to fight to come back. You have to fight to stay away from the lure of the power of evil. And war is evil. War is consummate evil. Even if you're fighting for good things, you end up doing bad things. And you have to fight to come out of it. It's a battle of immense, titanic proportions. I know veterans who are in their 80s who still fight every day to just try and be sane, to enjoy this world. It's so hard, and it wears them down so much.
What do you... What do you think helped you most make it through your first tour?
Well, I think I was so busy.
Okay.
What helped me? I was young. I was resilient. I had these questions. I had a good faith, and I had faith in my comrades, faith in myself. So much of war is about who you're with, and I was with a good group, and they were good men. And together, the sum of us was better than any of the individual parts, as I found out later. When I went to Fort Benning, I'd been there a month or two, and I got a call. Got a phone call from a second lieutenant, and he was a company commander over in the 191st Infantry Brigade, I think. Anyway, they're the support troops for the infantry school. And 3 of my guys in my old platoon, first platoon, had been assigned to him as NCOs. And he said, well, you know, right off, I didn't know this guy from Adam. You're Lieutenant Paris? Yes. Oh, you're the famous Lieutenant Paris. I hear about you all the time. Everything I do or say, well, that's not the way Lieutenant Paris would have done it. These 3 men of yours, they are the biggest pain in the ass of ever, on and on and on he goes. So I let him talk. I let him talk. He finally talked himself down. He's so frustrated with them. I said, fine, Lieutenant, you want to tell me what's going on? Well, I can't do anything with these 3 guys. You know, the colonels busted them all in rank. They won't do anything. They say they're not going to do anything. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no. So I said, well, where are they? And he said, well, I've got them confined to barracks. And I said, okay. I said, I'm coming over there. Do you mind? He said, no. As a matter of fact, if the great Lieutenant Paris would show up, I'd be happy. After my next class, I jumped in the car and went over there. He shows me where they are. They're sitting on their bunks smoking. They all got shadows on their arms from where their stripes used to be because, hell, I promoted. One was an E6, 2 were E5. And I walked in and it was like, Lieutenant Paris, standard attention. What? Standard attention. I put him in a brace and I said, what the hell do you guys think you're doing? Sir, we shut up. And come to find out, they had, I think, 4 months left, 3 months left. And, you know, that, quite frankly, they'd been through enough. They didn't want to play. They just wanted out of the Army. And then after probably within 3-4 months, and they'd been out of the Army by then, the Army changed the policy. And as soon as you came back from Vietnam, they discharged you, which was a good thing. But at any rate, I kind of got these guys half-assed straightened around, you know, that we'd all get together in the evenings and, you know, chat and talk and drink, because quite frankly, I was kind of lonely myself. I didn't know anybody at Fort Benning. And, but I know how they felt. I knew exactly how they felt. Kind of like, where the hell am I now? I used to know what I was doing. Now I'm in a strange place and everybody wants me to do this and that. Strangers in a strange land.
Did that help? Being able to hang out, talk with guys that have been...
Helped a little bit, but I also realized, you know, that this is just a momentary thing, and I'm going to have to get on now and replace this with something else. Mm-hmm. They left shortly thereafter, about a month after that, and they settled down a lot. And I settled down, too, because I realized, you know, hey, I looked around and I decided, this sucks. I'm going back to Vietnam anyway, so don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. So and then I just got on with it. In the fashion that we got on with things in those days.
Which was?
An immense amount of drinking and womanizing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't married.
Right, that didn't happen until just before you went to flight school.
Well, actually, it's how I spent my time until I went to flight school.
Okay.
I would teach and I would drink and such. Okay. Played flag football for Post and various things. Mm-hmm. I was always working on my education. Mm-hmm. I took correspondence courses in Vietnam, both tours. Went to classes at night, but boy, it was hard.
I'd imagine so.
Yeah. It was the last thing I wanted to do, but mm-hmm. The instructors understood. Mm-hmm. Most everybody had been to Vietnam or was on their way, and there was this. I have been to Fort Benning many times over the years. I've never seen Fort Benning like it was in 1968. There were a lot of first Cav widows there because mm-hmm. the division had deployed out of Fort Benning. There were a lot of people there between tours. There were a lot of widows there. There were a lot of young women there. There were a lot of scared people there. And it was, it's just hard to describe. But it was something. Mm-hmm. A lot of stress, very intense.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about with regard to your first tour? No. Or the training time in between where you were at Fort Benning?
No. We got together several times with some of the pilots from the 229th. They were over in Hunter Army Airfield, mm-hmm. and we got together several times.
Okay.
But no.
Now, at what point did you decide you wanted to become a pilot?
In OCS before I ever went to Vietnam the first time, but I was so exhausted. They gave you the test in about the 8th week, which was the wrong thing to do because you're right in the middle of all the heavy physical training and exertion. And this was not untypical. They'd bring you in the classroom, sit you down, give you the test, and you'd fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. First test, I got a zero because I slept right through it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So then I took it again and the at Fort Benning when I right after I first got there, and I passed it and put in for flight school, and so I left pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, during this, how long were you there at Fort Benning?
I was there 5.5 months.
Okay. What did you, okay, so you were there from July, I guess, until the end of the year, until December.
December.
Of 68.
Yeah, I got promoted right before I left to captain.
Now, did you maintain very much contact with guys back in Vietnam?
A little bit. Not too much because I, most of the guys I wanted to keep contact with were gone.
Okay. And how closely were you following the war in the news?
Every day.
Yeah.
Every day. I'd watch them.
Mm-hmm. How did that strike you?
Watching a war on the news?
Yeah.
Very surreal.
Yeah.
Very surreal.
What did you think about that as a policy?
Well, I thought the policy was okay, but some of the reporting was absolutely juvenile.
Mm-hmm.
It got to be quite irritating, and then I got swept up in shall we say, the social life, and so then I didn't really watch much news after that. I'd watch it a little bit, but my big thing was I didn't have any money. most of my money went to my sisters to pay for my children. I probably had $200 a month to live on. So I lived in a house with four guys, and we were all quite busy, but Saturday morning I had to watch George of the Jungle at 9 o'clock. That was my thing. Whether I was drunk or sober,
okay.
I watched George of the Jungle.
Okay.
George of the Jungle and Laugh In were my survival tools. Other than that, I could have cared less about TV. But yeah, if the news was on, I'd definitely keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had newspapers, and then a lot of that information over at the leadership lab we had access to, so we knew what was going on in the war, and we got all the classified stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what was really going on.
Okay. Now, as you were preparing to leave for flight school, of course, the election of 68 had occurred. Nixon had won.
Yep.
And what did you think?
Well, in this 5 month process where I was back to the States and then sort of plugging back into the mainstream of American thinking, I became very frightened that Hubert Humphrey would win. Wallace, I didn't worry about George Wallace. He was just, you know, being George Wallace. He didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. But the idea that Hubert Humphrey would get in there and we would continue with some more of the well-intentioned mumbo-jumbo with nobody really doing anything, just frightened the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon, I knew, was as much of a statesman as this nation's had since probably, hell, Franklin Roosevelt. And one of the few statesmen we've had in this century in the White House. And I knew he could handle it. So when he won, it was a close election, but I breathed a huge sigh of relief because, you know, people were saying at the time, well, you know, what are you going to do about Vietnam? And Nixon would say, well, I have a plan, but, you know, I'm not going to talk about it. Oh, so you have a secret plan. Well, you know, whatever you want to call it. So then it goes around, well, Nixon has a secret plan, but he's not going to tell it. You know, and a lot of it was just sour grapes by the media and the Democrats and their followers because they had screwed this thing up from A to Z. And once Nixon won the election, they realized, hey, we're about to dump this war. Hoorah. Now everything's going to be Nixon's fault. And so that's exactly what they did. They made everything Nixon's problem. But the military settled down a little. The military, I think, was far more apprehensive than the nation about having some more Democratic presidents in there wondering and wishing about what they ought to do.
Did you feel confident?
Yep. Plus, I knew I was going back, and that settled things down.
Now, did you really think that would be the case? I mean, you had, when you left in December of 68, you had a year of training ahead of you. Did you think the war was going to last that long?
When I first went over there, I was afraid it was going to end before I got there. When I left, I realized that I could relax about it. It was going to go on for a while.
Okay.
Until somebody came along who had an idea of what to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you left and went where did you get your initial flight training? Was it Rucker or was it here at Fort Walters?
It was Fort Walters.
Okay, so here in Texas, Fort Walters, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you go ahead and describe your introduction into the aviation branch of the military and what that was like.
My introduction to aviation is like being a private again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a very new captain, but even so, the flight classes were broken down into the officer contingent and then the warrant officer contingent, and these guys are warrant officer candidates. So you go, they have a company that you're attached to, so you go to the company, and then they announce that they would have a formation. It was like, what? Okay, fine, we'll have a formation. So 7 o'clock in the morning, all of us are standing out there, and we're all strangers, probably 120 officers, and this major walks out and announces that he's not going to take any shit off anybody. And I thought, what the hell is going on, for God's sakes? I just came here to be trained as a pilot. I didn't come here to listen to this. And all the stuff that, you know, and you will do this and you will do that. And it just sounded kind of like Mickey Mouse. So I thought, what the hell. And then they took us over and they issued us our flight gear. And it was, we marched everywhere just like we were privates. And then they knocked that off after we start bitching at them because it was like, hey, come on, you know. How about we don't do this? And they got a new commanding general in, and he had come from the CAV, and at the very first social event, a bunch of us who had been in the first CAV went up and said, General Barry, do you know we have to march everywhere? And he said, what? So that crap came to an end. But it was pretty easy duty. We normally had classes in the morning and flew in the afternoon, or vice versa, and then you had classes in the morning and you flew at night. We were only there 4 months. Joan came back from Japan. We set up housekeeping in a house trailer. And it went pretty fast. It was pretty idyllic. I was there on temporary duty orders, which the officers at the time did. You weren't assigned. You were only on temporary duty. So we got a temporary duty pay, which was nice. My pay doubled while I was there. Hell, I was making more between flight pay and temporary duty pay than I was for my regular base pay. I pulled out a slip the other day. When I went to flight school as a captain, before I drew flight pay, I was making $490 a month. So
That's pretty low.
Yeah. Of course, this was 1969, but even so, it was a real handsome wages.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that for 4 months. We took basic flight. We soloed, which was just a riot watching everybody solo a helicopter. They're very complicated machines to fly. It's not nearly as easy as it looks, although these days the helicopters are a lot easier to fly. The ones we had didn't have what's called articulated throttles. You jump in a helicopter now, and the pilot doesn't worry about keeping the RPM up. That's all taken care of for him. But in my day, we had to do it all ourselves. And so you had this throttle, and it would only stay open as long as you gripped it and held it open. So we had all that, as well as trying to fly those beasts. We had a 4 months. We were going on for phase two and three, and either went to Fort Rucker or Hunter Army Airfield. And I asked to go to Hunter Army Airfield, so we were sent out there. And got through, finished, we're starting to finish flight school. And we got our assignment orders for once we completed, and it was about a month away. Initial orders, you know, it's not necessarily the final word, but, you know, very few people are going to have their orders tweaked. So essentially what you got was where you were going to go. And I got orders to Fort Benning, Georgia. And I thought, I can't do this. And I talked to Joan, and I said, you know, I can't sit here and wait for a year or so. They were over on pilots in Vietnam, so all the classes that were graduating were just standing around waiting. So they were assigning them anywhere. And you, in those days, you had to fly, otherwise you didn't get paid. So the 10th Aviation Battalion at Fort Benning, Georgia, because I called them, they had like 600 pilots there trying to, you know, get through their minimums every month. And I thought, holy cow, I can't do this. And if I'm going back to Vietnam, I better go now or I'm not going at all. So I called the infantry branch like a good fellow and talked to this colonel, and he said, why are you calling? And I said, well, I was wondering if I could go to Vietnam because I don't want, you got your orders, you're going to Fort Benning, you know, when we need you, we'll call you. Click. Okay, so I have a lot of friends at Hunter Army Airfield, most of whom you've met.
Yeah.
So I talked to them, and I talked to some other folks, and they say, well, you know, what you need to do is you need to find something they need. And if you can get a school for it, they'll send you right over to Vietnam, and that's the quickest way to get there. So, So I call infantry branch again, and I talk to aviation assignments, even though I'm not a rated aviator yet. And I have a thing for LOCHs, light observation helicopters. I love scouts. I used to fly with them all the time on my first tour. Great fun. Low and slow, hovering around. Geez, that's my kind of flying. Bugs in your teeth. So I call up and I say, some warrant officer talks to me, and I said, Chief, I've been back in the States now for a while, and probably need to think about getting back to Vietnam. He said, well, how long have you been back? And I said, oh, almost 18 months. He said, what? Because experienced pilots were going back a lot sooner. So I said, yeah. I said, I really would like maybe a transition school into the 086 light observation helicopter and back to Vietnam. And he looks and he said, well, geez, I can't really do that because all those slots are filled and we're not getting many anymore because we're introducing the new LOCH. And my ears perked up and I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, the OH-58. He said they're just going to be coming online to Vietnam in probably about 4 months, maybe five. He said, would you be interested in going? He said, they're just starting the first IP class. You want to go to that? And then I'll send you on to Vietnam from there. I said, well, sure, that'd be great. Now, you got to understand, in aviation, usually the instructor pilot ought to be a guy who's got more than just the basic minimum to qualify as an Army aviator. As a matter of fact, I might even go so far as to say that this shouldn't happen. And I knew it. And so I said, yeah, put me down. So he gets my name and everything, and I know by now my records have been shipped over to the aviation branch because they made the assignments when they cut our orders, and they shipped the records over. So he gets my name and everything. He said, I'll make sure you get the orders. You'll have them in about a week. And I said, okay. And then Joan and I wanted to go to the Bahamas for a little bit. And in those days, you had to have orders. So had him authorize that, okay, you know, 5 days delay en route to the Bahamas, okay. So he gets that all set up, and he said, you sure you wouldn't rather go to a gunship? He said, I got a bunch of Cobra openings. Well, my stick buddy was standing right behind me. He wanted gunships so bad. And I said, no, I don't, but I've got a guy right here who does. So he got my buddy, who we were supposed to finish up on a Tuesday, and on Monday he went over to Cobra Hall. So he never did quite finish the course before he was over taking transition training. And they sent me off. They gave me a set of orders, sure enough. Joan and I had orders now for Vietnam, so we could at least get that under our belt and out of the way, because it was just too hard to contemplate having to sit around and wait for that. So I got orders for the very first OH-58 IP school. And so I graduate, and then I wait around, oh, I don't know, 2.5, 3 weeks. And I worked for Joan over at the Education Center where she was working. I was just sort of a volunteer in the Army, what they call blackbirds, you know, guys who have finished their courses waiting for orders. Mm-hmm. So I worked for her for a couple of weeks, so we went in together. And then I took off for Fort Rucker. When I got down to Fort Rucker, I show up and I walk in and, are you here for the 58 IP school? Yes, sir. Well, put your records on the desk. Now, everybody has these big flying records, big thick jacket. I walk up with my brand new 5 pieces of paper jacket and throw it on the table and go and have a seat. And then this warrant officer comes in, picks up the records, and leaves the room. So this colonel gives us a briefing, welcome, you know, yada, yada. And, you know, you'll be here for, I can't even remember how long it was. I think it was a month, maybe 5 weeks. And, you know, don't worry about things. You know, we're pretty informal, be here ready to go. Yeah, it was great. So chief is going to make the assignments on who's going to fly with who, and he'll assign the, he'll assign you to the SIPs, which is the, these are the super instructor pilots, standardization guys, and they're qualified to do everything. These are the guys who teach IPs how to do their job. So we're sitting there, and he's calling out names, and he calls out everybody's name but mine. And they all leave to go sit at tables with their instructor pilots. He says, Captain Paris? And I said, yeah, Chief. He said, sir, you come with me. Uh-oh. So he takes me in his office, shuts the door very quietly, and turns around and yells at me, what in the goddamn hell are you doing here? You have no business being here. Shit, you just graduated a couple of weeks ago. You don't have enough stick to on and on and on. So I let him kind of go for a little bit, and I finally said, Chief, I have to go. You can't, he said, I can't put you through this course. Do you know what a travesty that would be, not to mention the fact you can't do it? So I said, well, yes, I can do it. And I said, there's two reasons why I can't go back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and that's why I'm here. And I said, the first one is I just got married. And my wife and I emotionally can't handle waiting to go on the second tour. I'd just as soon go now. We're all geared up for it. And this was the only way I could find to get through it. And I'm sorry if I've screwed up your life and your school, but I think I can do it. And, you know, and if you're any kind of an IP at all, I'm a pretty good pilot. I'm not the greatest you'll ever see, but I'll learn. And he said, what's the other reason? And I'm not going to tell you the other reason, but once he heard it, he said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'm going to take a chance on you. And he said, you're going to be with me.
And he said, "I'm going to be twice as hard on you as any other pilot in this school." And he said, "Captain, you screw up one time and you're out of here. But if you do your job, I'll never say a word to anybody about this." So that was the deal, and I did it. And I made it through, and I graduated. And I was in the first graduating class of instructors for the OE 58. And I guess in a gully. Mm-hmm. So then it was, we had to leave. Joe and I went down to the Bahamas, and a lot of stress, a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, newly married, hadn't even come up on our first anniversary yet, and I'm off for Vietnam. So we went down to the Bahamas, and finally, after about 2 days, Joan said, "I can't take this anymore. Why don't we just do it?" So I said, "Okay, let's go." So we went back home, and I reported in early, and I went over to Vietnam on my second tour.
Now, when you, as you were nearing your next, your date of departure for Vietnam, did you get some leave time?
Yeah.
Okay. Another 30-day leave?
And they gave us 30 days. I think I took 10.
Okay. And what time frame is this now that you're preparing to leave for Vietnam for the second
tour? This is November of 1969.
It's November 69.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot had been going on.
Yep.
During that year. See, a couple of memorable events. For instance, Hamburger Hill.
Yeah.
Do you remember hearing about that? And
I've got a letter from Teddy Kennedy in my file.
Pardon?
I said, "I have a letter from Senator Ted Kennedy that I keep in my file."
And what does the letter say?
I wrote him a letter because he stood up on the floor of the Senate and said, you know, essentially, bad, 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 nasty people. You're, you know, killing off all these Americans, and this is stupid, and yada, yada. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, "Senator, in 1964, you voted on the floor of that Senate for the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. I remember. And you supported that war when your brother, when he was president, and President Johnson, when he was in the White House, said we had to go to war. And you voted right down the party line for it." And I said, "And now, you know, it comes around and the Army is doing what you sent it over there to do, and you're complaining because it didn't work out the way that you thought it should." And I said, "Senator, I'm real sorry, but you should have thought of this when you were voting all of this stuff, because what did you think was going to happen?" And so I got a letter back. "You know, dear Captain Paris, gee, I'm really sorry we don't agree, you know, but that's the way it is, love." And so I stuck that in my records. And I thought, you know, you two-faced son of a bitch, way to go.
Well.
But, yeah, I was very supportive of the war effort and the people over there because, you know, I just thought it was stupid what they were doing back here. They should have thought of all that. You know, and I also had some faith that Nixon would do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what, but I figured he would in fact do something. He wasn't the kind to sit on his hands and, you know, whine about it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so, yeah, I remember Hamburger Hill very clearly.
What did you think about this, though, in the context of, again, getting back to the idea of strategy and the issue of attrition and the fact that What Hamburger Hill, I think, maybe epitomized for a lot of people was this notion that here we are, we go, we fight, we lose all these men to take this hill, and then we abandon it, knowing full well that more than likely we're going to have to go back and take the hill all over again. And
well,
so this idea that we just keep on throwing bodies after bodies after bodies after bodies, and
okay,
but there's no specific goal.
Your question is out of context. To be honest with you, that applied up until June of '68 when Westmoreland left. then the fellow that replaced him was General Creighton
Abrams. Right.
And General Abrams was probably one of the most savvy folk I've ever run into. And what the 101st was doing in the Oshaw Valley was not, their primary mission was not to get in a fight. What they were doing was they were going in, taking out supply depots, mining the road. What General Abrams was starting to do was to try and block by non-human means enemy access, these high-speed avenues of approach that we always talk about. And what the 101st was doing out there was exactly that. Now, on Hamburger Hill, they ran into elements of an NBA division that were there to dispute that. And so, yes, they left the hill. Yes, they, you know, they got a bunch of people killed. But what they were doing was defending the area so that the engineers and the other folks could do their work. Of course, we didn't realize at the time the extensive supply system that they had either. I mean, it wasn't until we got over into Cambodia 6 months or a year later that we realized, holy cow, these guys got better stuff than we do, and more of it. But we didn't know that. And so at the time, it made sense what he was doing. Sure, you know, it would have been nice if they could have just backed off and not had that fight, but unfortunately, the lead elements were cut off, and they had to fight. And there were times in the future when we had to fight. So it had changed subtly, and the press never understood that until much later. And by then, they didn't care what was really going on. They were so invested in telling everybody what they wanted them to hear and what they wanted to hear that, you know, that the press took a left. And their reporting of the war just became total bullshit, you know, I'd say before Hamburger Hill ever happened. They didn't stay current. They didn't stay up on what the military was trying to do. They just started telling their own story. And it caused us a lot of problems later on. It got a lot of good people killed because they're telling everybody what they want to hear, to include the enemy. And it's a problem that we ran into that we had not encountered since the Civil War, of a press that almost openly favors the other guy. It was an incredible experience. So at any rate, that's what really was going on with that whole thing in Hamburger Hill. And yeah, the 101st didn't want to be there any more than anybody else, and they weren't real happy about it, but they had to.
Right.
They had to bring that thing to its conclusion, but I'll tell you this, they never did it again.
And well, yeah, I mean, one of the...
Abrams learned his lesson.
And also one of the orders issued after, well, I don't know if the order would be appropriate, but certainly one of the directives from the president that was issued immediately after Hamburger Hill was minimize U.S. casualties.
You bet. And it, even though it was accidental, sped up that process, although, you know, as we used to say, I don't know how you minimize casualties when everybody has loaded guns, but we'll give it a try. And so by the time I got over there on my second tour, then if I thought I was confused before, I really was confused when I got back over there. In my mind, I thought I was going back to what I'd left. Good people, good esprit, you know, high morale. What I found when I got over there my second time was it was as big a shock as when I got back to the United States the first time. I didn't, you know, it looked like Vietnam. It certainly smelled like it. But it was incredible to me how in 16 and a half months, things could change that radically. And it was bad. You know, it was really. It absolutely floored me. I had the night before I left, just to set the stage, and throw in an anecdote, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
We had a big party, and we invited all the guys from the 229th who were at Hunter's IPs. So they all came over, and we wet down my wings. And we wet them down, but good, and we were wetting until about 4 in the morning, and I had to leave. My plane left at like 7:45 that morning. So, and I mean, I staggered off to bed. Joan and I went to bed, got up. And as part of the closing ceremony, they gave the aviators toast. And I don't know, did you hear it? When Beaver did it? Was it Beaver?
Mm-hmm.
But the aviators toast, that was always a big...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We always had to have that at any of our gatherings. And so as they gave me the aviator's toast, everybody dumped their drinks on my head. And there are a wide variety of drinks. I mean, really wide variety. And so I went off to bed, and I didn't shower. I needed to get some sleep. So I got up, and there was just enough time to make the plane if I ran like hell. So I threw everything in the bag, said goodbye to the kids. Joan drove me out to the airport in Savannah, and I'm sticky. I mean, like, sticky. My hair is sticky. I'm sticky all over. I washed, you know, just quick spit bath kind of thing, but that didn't work real well. So I get on this airplane. I'm hungover. I'm tired, you know. I'm scared again. I don't want to be here, but away I go. I get to Vietnam. I'm still sticky. I have, you know, just haven't had a chance because in those days, you didn't stop at Oakland Army Terminal on my second tour. My first tour, you got there, you had 2 days, you know, you got on a flight, you left. Oh no, these days, this is the whole different thing. I flew out, I landed at San Francisco, caught a bus or something, went down to Travis Air Force Base, waited around a couple hours, got on a plane, went to Vietnam. So I end up at 90th Replacement Battalion after a 22-hour plane ride, and I really need a shower bad. I'm 2 days into wearing the aviator's toast. But everything I see looks so disjointed. I mean, you see enlisted men walking around with beads on, peace signs, John Lennon sunglasses. And I thought, what in the hell is going on? Where am I? Talk to some of the guys who are leaving and going home or going on R&R, and they say, oh, especially the second tour guys, they say, look out, baby, it's changed and it's bad. We got racial problems, we got drug problems, we got problems like you wouldn't believe. These guys ain't the guys that you were with a couple years ago. These guys are bad news. And I thought, oh, I have made a serious error in judgment.
When you, on the flight over, what was the atmosphere like on the aircraft?
Oh, the usual. Very quiet. People reading, you know, and particularly the second tour guys, it's like, here we go again. Don't want to be here.
How many second tour guys would you estimate were on that aircraft with you?
Probably 10% of the complement.
Okay.
Maybe even a few more.
Were a lot of the people on that flight with you other fellow aviators or crew members?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a smattering, but, you know, on that flight over, you're not very chatty anyway. You don't really care. You know, it's like nobody wants to talk much. The new guys are, you know, they're feeling pretty grim, and the guys who have been around before, they really don't want to talk about it, because it's like, shit, I got to go do this again, don't I?
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
it's a very quiet group.
were you going over as a group to replace en masse?
No, no.
Okay.
Always going over as an individual.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Well, what did you think about that system? The individual replacement system and the individual rotation. Well,
yeah.
And also, of course, couple that with the one-year rotation system because you can't separate the two.
Yeah. I mean, everybody liked the fact you only had to be there a year, but nobody liked the fact that, you know, you were constantly relearning the same lessons over and over and over again. You know, the old joke used to be, we haven't been to Vietnam for 7 years. We've been on a one-year tour in Vietnam 7 times. And that, you know, even though they did their best, operational lessons learned, yada, yada, you know, all the experience kept leaving the unit, and you always are breaking in new guys and always teaching, you know, the same old lessons all over again. And it produced casualties that didn't need to be, quite frankly. But by the same token, if you keep people over there, then eventually people are going to want to know why their son's been in Vietnam for 5 damn years. So politically, it makes sense. Get them out. Because the American people would have had a cow. They had a cow anyway.
Well, at the same time, even though, again, don't want to compare apples to oranges here, but in the, of course, in Second World War, the Korean War, all wars prior to the Vietnam War, just about, very rarely was there the notion of you're only in for a certain amount of time, and then you can go. And
yeah.
Of course, one of the exceptions to that, of course, was the American Revolution.
Well, the Korean War was where they first tried that system out.
But, I mean, guys that went over for the Second World War were over for the duration.
Yeah.
Same thing for the First World War, although much more brief of a war for us, for the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Yep.
And, of course, the same for the Civil War.
Yep.
But
although the Civil War regiments, they were in for fixed enlistment periods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they went for 1, 2, or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them only 9 months. So it was actually, the First World War was the first war we fought where you were there for until it's over.
Mm.
Because the other wars, it didn't last long enough. The Revolutionary War was an ugly one.
Yeah.
I can't imagine doing that for 5, 6 years.
Right.
Some of them did.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly think it would have saved us a lot of problems had we stuck with that.
Well, other than what you've already stated as your initial observations, what else did you notice was different? And especially in terms of the command climate. And, you know, you're from comparing your second tour to your first tour.
of course, it took a few days to get to a unit, but I was just stunned by watching the guys around Saigon. They had lost most military cohesion. They really looked bad. And I figured if Saigon is like this, I can imagine what's going on the field. And of course, we had heard a little bit about drugs over in Vietnam. We'd heard a little bit about, you know, racial problems. And there had been a fragging or two, but when you step into it, it's like, oh, my God, what is this place? But it really didn't sink in until I got to the unit I was assigned to. And since I was the first OH-58 IP in country, I got pulled off to go to the 11th Armored Cav Regiment because they were supposed to be the first unit to get the OH-58 as a scout aircraft. And so they plucked me out of the pool, as it may be, and pulled me over there. And when I got to the 11th ACR and I checked in, they assigned me to the headquarters troop to the aviation detachment, which just drove me crazy. And the aviation officer and I had a lot of squabbles until made, though, after they kind of picked my head for a while, was they decided to stick with the 086 and not jeopardize things the way they were going by bringing in the 058.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right to do it. It's a gutless aircraft for what they were going to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So after 3 weeks of kicking around, cooling my heels, flying colonels here, there, and everywhere, and majors, I finally was sent down to the Air Cav Troop. Because the Air Cav, the Aero Scout platoon leader, had a mechanical problem, didn't know how to solve it. So he crashed his aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to the States, and I used that as an opportunity to go down and replace him. So I went down, I got to the unit on Thanksgiving Day of 1969. That's when I got to, I got to the Air Cav Troop on, I hit the Air Cav Troop on Thanksgiving Day, and I walked in the mess hall. I hadn't eaten because I'd been flying for regiment in the morning, and then they told me, well, go ahead and go down first to the Air Cav Troop. So I walked in down there to the mess hall, and everything was gone. And the mess sergeant said, what do you need? And I said, well, I was hoping to get dinner. I haven't had any. I said, sorry. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, welcome to the war, Bill. I thought, kiss my grits. Look at this. They assigned me to take over the Aero Scout platoon.
Okay.
And looking around, we were at a base north of Saigon, probably 40 miles up on the edge of War Zone C. And ourselves in the first Cav, they had people there too, aviation assets, some infantry. We were at a place called Quan Loi. It had been a plantation and a little community near the village of Anlock. And it at one time had been very pretty, but it was just all red clay when I was there. So I called everybody together, as is my wont as a leader, and I explained to them who I was, where I came from, and what I expected. One of the things that I told them was that I understand that some people over in Vietnam use drugs. And I let them know in no uncertain terms that drugs are illegal, and I catch anybody, I want to crucify them. Leave the damn drugs alone. We got enough to do without worrying about that. Nobody said a word. So then I went over and talked to the officers, told them the same thing. I had a few different policies for them. I told them all that, you know, we were flying scout missions is a particularly hazardous and perilous business, and that as far as I was concerned, they were strictly volunteers, and that any man who had had enough, I didn't want him to worry about it, get in a stew about it. I wanted him to come on up and tell me he was done, and he would be done. I'd get him assigned somewhere, and it would be no shame, nothing. That you only got so much of this stuff, and when the tank's empty, it's empty. And that was my policy, and I followed through on it. Well, that night, I went to bed, and there were five of us stayed in what was called a platoon leader's hooch. Six of us, I guess. And so there was a tap at the door. One of the captains gets up and says, what? And he says, Captain Paris here. Yeah, Paris, you got visitors. And I thought, what the hell? Well, it's dark. You can't see your hand in front of your face, hardly. So I get up. Yeah, what do you want? Can you come on out here, sir? Well, yeah, sure. I go outside. What's up? "Well, we heard your little speech today, and it's obvious you being new, you don't know how things are." And I thought, "Well, interesting, a delegation of Knight Riders." So I said, "Well, why don't you tell me how things are?" And he said, "Well, we use drugs. You need to know that. We use drugs because it's what we do. We don't care whether you like it or not. You got to live with us, and we got to live with you. So here's the thing. You leave us alone, and you stand a good chance of maybe making your tour. You fuck with us, you're dead." And I said, "Well..." In my mind, I'm thinking, "What?" Excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, let me get this straight now. You guys all use drugs? Well, not all of us, but enough. Oh, I see. So all these faces I can't see, you guys are the guys who use drugs? Yeah, that's right. And so you're telling me that if I make an issue out of this, that something bad might happen, huh? Yeah, that's about it. And I said, "So you're willing to do all this just for your drugs?" "Well, if you want to put it that way, yeah." "Okay, well, that's kind of the way I want to put it." And I said, "So, you know, since I don't know anything about drugs, and you guys obviously do because you took the time to come and call on me, why don't you tell me this? Let's just say I buy into this. What does that mean?" "Well, it means, you know, nothing. We just, you know, do our thing and you do yours." "Oh, I see." And I said, "So, well, I'm doing my thing, whatever that is. Are you guys doing drugs?" "Well, not during the day." "Oh. So if I go out on a mission, I don't have to worry about you being on drugs? Is that what you're telling me?" "Yeah." "So when are you going to do these drugs? When you're back doing maintenance on the helicopters?" "No, if we got work to do, we do the work, then we do the drugs." "I see. And everybody's like that, huh?" "Yeah." "Okay." And I said, "So I either do this or something bad is going to happen, but you guys are going to police yourselves?" "Yep, that's the way it is." I said, "Okay." So I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I have a vested interest in making it through this war, and since I don't have much choice because there's a bunch of you and just one of me, and obviously I don't know who you are, I said, I'll take your deal because I really don't have a choice. But since you son of a bitches are holding the gun to my head, I'm going to tell you this, that the deal is this. You can do your drugs or whatever it is that you got to do after the maintenance, after the mission. But I said, if I catch you during the day doing this shit, I don't give a fuck if you shoot me right on the spot. I'm going to get you right then and there. How's that sound?" "Oh, yeah, that's cool." "Okay. Deal."
Okay. Now, did you talk with other officers in your unit?
You
had they struck? Had they struck similar deals with their men?
Well, one of them said to me that, you know, it had never occurred to him to say anything about drugs, and frankly, he didn't think that he could foresee in the future where he would bother.
So, in other words, he had already made up his mind that it was a non-issue to him. He wasn't going to make an issue of it.
Yeah, and a lot of the guys felt that way. Right. It was like, look, I can't beat it, and I'm not going to mess with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was pissed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jesus, I was. I can't tell you how upset I was, but I thought, okay, you know, I got enough to worry about by getting killed by NBA. I don't want to worry about the guys behind me.
Right.
So we went out and we flew our missions, and it was hairy stuff. I mean, we primarily flew what's called pink teams. A gunship up at about 1,500 feet, and he's supposedly watching you all the time. And then the scout aircraft at treetop level or below.
Mm-hmm.
The theory is that, you know, you're down there performing visual reconnaissance. You see all these signs. You give first, you know, eyewitness intelligence, and if they open fire on you, the Cobra just dumps the nose and kills them all, and you both return happy to the club and have a beer. Mm-hmm. The reality sometimes is far more awkward, as reality always is. Mm-hmm. And I quickly got into the business of losing pilots and aircraft. In the 5.5 months I commanded that platoon, I lost 17 aircraft, 21 pilots, and probably 18 enlisted men.
Where was your principal base camp again?
We were at Quan Loi.
Quan Loi, and what was the range of your operations, and what into what area?
Well, we operated War Zone C to the Cambodian border. Actually, we had a 3-mile limit, mm-hmm. that you weren't to approach any closer, and a 3-mile on the other side. Oddly enough, both sides of that limit were beaten to shit with B-52 strikes, and I thought, my, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we did a lot of work supporting the Rome Plow companies, which mm-hmm. were gutting out the jungle, mm-hmm. and our cab squadron.
Okay.
And,
wow. And you said, and that was just a 5.5-month tour.
Well, it was as long as I wanted. I could only stay on 5.5 months. Mm-hmm. I got shut down twice.
My goodness. Now, and this was in Loches.
Loches, yeah.
Were you guys doing the hunter-killer team scenarios?
Yep.
With the Cobras?
Yep. That was us.
And you're principally going up against NVA at this point.
Oh, yeah. No VC. These are hardcore main force.
Wow.
And these guys know the drill, mm-hmm. and they're good at what they do.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in that 5.5-month period, mm-hmm. I had many, many interesting leadership challenges. Mm-hmm. Got shot down twice, shot up once. Mm-hmm. But I only walked away with one Purple Heart, and I had the lowest number of anybody in that unit.
Oh, my.
Everybody had, mm-hmm. you know, several. And, of course, the policy was if you got 3, then you were done.
Okay.
And you could no longer go on active operation.
Right. Okay.
So what would happen was I found my more aggressive pilots just weren't reporting things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had the platoon. Oh, gosh. Probably not much more than 2 months when I got shot down the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bad one.
Okay. I hate to do this.
No, it's okay. This would be a good time to stop it.
I was just going
to
say, I would have to take a break.
Yeah.
Fine. Let me.
Me too.
Thank you. This has been a really good interview. Let me pause this real quick.